Hey, Ann Barr.
Hey, Karen Beatty.
We need a promo. You know, like where we talk about what we do on our podcast.
On our sugar-coated murder podcast? Like how we love to bake and talk about murder?
That's what we need to talk about.
There you go.
I think we've talked about it. Y'all find us on all your favorite listening apps.
Stay sweet.
And don't murder.
Because if you kill people,
we will talk about you.
The Murder Shelf Book Club contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome, Murder Bookies, to the Murder Shelf Book Club podcast. I am your host, Jill. I hope the holidays are going well, and this is episode 79, A Sugar-Coated Interview, with Ann Varner and Karen Devaney of the Sugar-Coated Murder podcast, the authors of Click, Click, Click. My podcast features the best true crime books out there, and this is one of them. So frustratingly, many of us have no time to read, so I read for you. Now, a little bit about our authors, Karen Devaney and Ann Varner. They are sisters who grew up in Franklin, Virginia, which is where this case of missing and murdered Trent Ritley takes place. These ladies are truly my spirit sisters. They have their hearts in the right place. And this is the first book in a series that they call Say My Name, which emphasizes the importance of remembering the victims. I really encourage you to read the book, Click, Click, Click. And now I'll introduce you to Anne and Karen.
Thank you for doing this.
Well, thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for having us, Jill. We appreciate it.
Oh, gosh, I love you guys. We had such a great time talking at CrimeCon. Yes. Then I read your book, and I was like, yes, yes.
Thank you.
This needs to be featured on the podcast.
Oh, thank you.
Any excuse to hang out with you guys, it's all cool.
I know.
I want you to know, I was just listening with my husband before, and you were talking about octoballs, and he was dying. He was just dying. Just, we were howling. It was just so awesome. I said, yeah, this is why I love these ladies. I get their sense of humor. They get my sense of humor. It's awesome.
It's all the same. It's all the same sense of humor. It's just sick and twisted. And we never know what's going to come out of our mouths.
No, we don't.
Freaking love it.
Now it's a thing. Hashtag octoballs.
Absolutely.
Awesome.
Okay. Jump right in here, giving you much chance to breathe. But one of the first questions I have for you is, where did the title come from? Click, click, okay. Click.
I'll take that.
You go ahead.
By the way, coming up with a title for your book is one of the hardest parts about writing the book.
I agree.
And a lot of people say, oh, the book will name itself. And it kind of did.
Yeah.
We had written all of the words and we were trying to put things in order. And there is a place in the book where the two killers and their victim are out at the scene of the crime before the crime has happened. And one of the murderers has a gun in his hand that the victim does not know exists. And he is cocking it and uncocking it. And it's making this click, 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 click. And the victim doesn't hear it, but the other murderer does. And in the book, he's trying to figure out, is that him cocking and uncocking the gun? And why is he doing that? Is he trying to intimidate the victim? Or like, he's freaking me out. Like, why is he making that noise? And so as we were going through it, we just were like, okay, that's a huge turning point, I think, in the book, is when that the cocking and the uncocking of the gun, you know it's coming.
And then later in the book, there's a scene where one of the murderers is in his car and he turns his turn signal on. And that same click, click, click goes.
Takes him right back to that scene.
Yeah.
Thank you for that, because I was wondering, as I remember both those sections in the book, and I remember thinking, is that in there because of something else? You wanted to use that name, or did the name stem from these two events? And like you said, it named itself from those instances.
Yeah, it really did.
It did.
I don't think I want to think about writing a book. I have a hard enough time keeping up with the podcast.
Well, so, excuse me. I'm going to reach over and try to get the jar of treats. Is it this one? This one.
I'm going to see if I can quiet him down a little.
Well, we like puppies. We like pets. We like kitties. They're welcome to join in and be a co-host.
Don't worry.
I think that his pitch would not be appreciated by your listeners.
High pitch. But anyway, writing a book is very difficult. I'm going to tell you, we've started this much on the second book. This much. I think 1,500 words is what we've written so far. We got a long ways to go.
Oh, boy.
200 pages. What? 200 pages.
Oh, I'm hoping that over Christmas break, we can get some stuff done.
Get focused in.
So it's been difficult.
You know, you talk a little bit in the book about how the book came about.
Yes.
How did you get the guts to do it?
I don't know.
Well, so Jill, for us, we come up with the most harebrained things to do. And when we come up with these harebrained ideas, we just do it.
We don't look through what are the consequences.
Or what does this entail? We just are like, oh, we have all of this information. What are we going to do with it? Well, we should write a book. Okay, let's write a book. 2 months later, we were like, I think we should start writing that book. And we did.
It literally fell into our laps, though. You know, you're reading along. The way that it came about is one of the murderers reached out to us. And we ended up meeting with him face to face.
Another harebrained idea.
I don't know what we were thinking. I really don't. And we still ask each other, what were we thinking? When we went and met with him face to face in an office with the door locked, just the three of us.
And nobody knew where we were.
We didn't tell anybody
what we were doing.
Yeah. That is like a violation of True Crime 101.
Yes.
You plaster, right? All over social media. I am going here to meet a person I haven't met yet. Well, look, he happens to be a murderer.
I know.
And you didn't tell
anybody. So what happened was we asked people about going. We asked the lead detective in the case, who we had talked to extensively, and said, hey, the guy wants to sit down and meet with us and tell us his side of the story. And he was like, you should not do that. We're like, oh, well, let's ask somebody else. And we actually
he said the wrong answer.
We asked dad, and now we're going to go ask mom. So you know who Catherine Ramsland is, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, we had seen her at Savannah Crime Expo that year, and we had seen her talk on Dennis Rader and all the, you know, her writing the book with him. And this, I got this harebrained idea that I would write to her and say, hey, we've got this murderer from our hometown that's out of jail now, and he wants to meet with us and tell us his side of the story. Do you have any advice for us on how to control the situation or how to control the narrative? And she wrote back and said, you absolutely should not do this. You're not professional. You're not prepared for this. And I would never recommend for somebody to do this. So I was like, looks like we're doing it.
Okay. So we've talked to the COG. We've talked to the expert in criminal psychology, and they both said, don't do it. We're going.
We're going to do it and not tell anybody.
Yeah, so we just won't tell.
Typical toddlers.
Yeah. That's the kind of stuff we do. We're really dangerous as sisters. That's the problem.
Yeah. Our family sometimes tries to keep us apart.
For good reason.
I don't know if I would have the guts. I think you're incredibly brave for doing it. But thank you for doing it.
Yes, but I wouldn't do it by myself. But I would go with my sister any time of the day. Like any time. I would never do it by myself.
Right. Agreed. But one thing to consider, too, is we grew up in the same town with this person. We knew him. We knew his family, his brothers, you know. So I think at the time we were more relating, even though we had had multiple conversations on the phone where we cried and we hung up and we were like, I think I had PTSD from that conversation. We still kind of thought of him as that kid that we grew up with.
Yeah.
So I don't think until we sat down and heard the click of the door.
Yeah.
We were like, holy crap.
Another click.
And then later when we came out, we were shell-shocked.
Yeah, there's a big difference between having a phone conversation and not seeing the person's face and having a face-to-face conversation about how he murdered another person and realizing that you can have caring words or enunciate your words in a certain way, but your face is telling a different story.
Yeah.
What story was his face telling you? In the book, you are very much in his head, and that fascinated me.
Yeah.
You know, I've done dozens of books at this point, and I've read many, many on murderers. You know, just fun time at my house with my library. But I don't always get the sense that, they're telling us the truth.
No.
When you're being interviewed or you're getting a transcript from a discussion with a police officer or,
right.
You know, they're still, even years later, they're still kind of bending that truth while Mike seemed to be talking a lot about himself, but thank you, I got that internal dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think he's truthful about at least his perceptions and what was going on in his head. Still seemed to be downplaying a little.
Yes.
Yeah. You know,
absolutely truthful about the facts of the case. Truthful
yes.
About this is how we planned it. This is how we covered it up. This is how we got away with it. Very truthful, almost to the point of pride.
Right.
And that's what's disturbing. Right. He's proud that he did it.
Yeah, I'm not painting him as overly honest.
Right. He's proud that he did it. He got away with it. He was smarter than the cops. He was smarter than the town. So that comes from a place of pride. And it's, I think, as a completely unprofessional psychology junkie, it's very difficult to have remorse and pride at the same time.
Agreed.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That they're talking to him. There was no, I mean, Ann and I would get emotional about the things he was saying, but there was not, he got upset with us when we showed emotion.
Yeah. He would say, let's keep podcast out of it.
Let's keep the podcasters out of it. I'm talking one-on-one.
We're human beings and you've upset me because you're describing this poor boy's brain matter all over your clothes.
Yeah.
And that is upsetting to me. Of course, we didn't say anything. We just kind of sat there dumbfounded, you know.
Well, and when we did get emotional, he threatened to shut it down. And we wanted to get this story from him.
Yeah.
So we had to sit in it.
And even after all of that was said and done, and we knew we were going to write a book, we had his permission to write a book.
Yeah.
We had all of the information. We reached out to him several times while we were writing the book. When it got to the point where we said, okay, the book is written and we've sent it to the beta readers, which are the people who do the review for you to say, this is garbage. I don't understand this. Or did you go to grammar school? You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And he wanted a copy of it. And we were like a week away from publishing.
We were probably 30 days away from publishing, but we had to rush the publishing because he wanted to insert himself in it. And, you know, this is something that Ann and I worked on ourselves for 9 months. That's our baby.
Yeah.
I don't care what the story is. These words and the way that we expressed it, that's our brainchild.
Right.
And we weren't willing to just give it over to somebody.
Well, and he came back, he looked at some of it and he was like, oh, you can't leave that out. That will really upset my family.
Oh, you have to leave it out.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. You have to leave that out because that'll upset my family.
Or that makes me look bad.
Really?
He would say, oh, well, this part makes me look bad.
Well, how much worse can you look? You killed a guy.
You killed a guy. He's worried about how people are going to perceive him, the convicted murderer, confessed murderer.
Yes.
And he's worried about how this part, what that part is going to play out. Whoa.
It really highlighted because he wanted to take control. He thought that we were going to write a book with him, that he was going to tell us what to write and we were going to write it down.
Sure he did.
The strong Southern women. Mm-hmm. And that's not who Karen and I are.
No,
we're not going to be told what to do.
No. So we actually published 2 weeks early.
We rushed it.
We called our editor and said, this has to go. We did. We talked to a lawyer. We talked to two attorneys.
Yeah.
We talked to a corporate attorney. And then we talked to
a copyright
attorney who actually teaches. She's written books and she's been on our podcast. She's wonderful. And she teaches classes about copyright.
Yes.
So we engaged with her and she just gave us some advice and said, I think you're covered.
Well, we had everything in writing and tape recordings.
We had him on the recording. I mean, he sat with us for 4.5 hours recording this, knowing that we were going to write a book.
Yeah.
So,
and we didn't hide anything from him the whole way. We asked him questions about, you know, the hat. His friend went back and got the hat the next day and then wore it to basketball practice. We asked him about that and he clarified it for us.
We didn't make anything up.
Mm-mm.
So,
no, you didn't have to. You had his cooperation.
Exactly. First book, he's threatening to, I no longer give you permission to. We were like, too late.
We were like, I said, don't read that email. And we published and we didn't read the email until after we published. And then we were like, oh gosh, we didn't read this email until after we published. Sorry.
Oopsie.
Yeah.
Last email to him was, no, you're no longer allowed to be in touch with us.
Yes. We no longer want any contact from you.
Yeah. So.
Well, yeah. I was going to say, first, I can see why he would get cold feet. Yeah, you know, he, you know, when I was talking about things that he was telling you, I was also going back to the teenager who lost his dad, who goes down the rabbit hole of, you know, laughing out at his family and his poor mother and all of this. And, you know, it's a conspiracy. And then that takes over.
Yes.
But the guilt is there from the beginning. I mean, he's wrestling with that.
Yeah.
So I ruled him out as a psychopath, but he is totally narcissistic here.
Yes. Yeah.
Because in his explanation, it is in his head, but it's all about him in his head.
Yes.
It really is. It is. And I guess you can read about that kind of a personality, but until you really and truly experience it firsthand, you don't understand the depth of logic that for me, I can't make the connections, but it's the way he thinks.
Right.
And it's really difficult to deal with that. And then also knowing on top of that, how can you not have been humbled when you took a human life? Like, wouldn't that humble a person? And it didn't. So then you think, my gosh, this is off. Like, this is way off.
Yeah.
Because for me, I'm just, you know, we were so empathetic to this boy who lost his life at 17 years old. He lost his life. He no longer existed. He didn't get to graduate from high school. He lost his life and what all of that meant and what that meant to his family. And so we were in a very empathetic feeling about this whole thing, which really, truly a narcissist angered him.
Right.
Because it seemed like we were on the victim's side and not on his side.
You're not focusing on him.
Right.
A narcissist can't put up with that. You're telling the story of how I did this thing. Yeah. And the target, oh, well, he's irrelevant. My planning went into this and, you know, how I drove the car and my feelings about all of this and how I had to deal with my guilt and my poor family. And never making that gulf is way too wide. He's not going to make that jump and say, Oh, the victim. You feel bad for him. No, he can't. No, that's not going to happen. Does that come out in the book?
Yeah, well, I'm glad that it does come out and that people that read it are understanding that. Because I think for Anne and I, we don't want to just highlight, I mean, our main goal, of course, is to highlight Trent and his life and how it ended so senselessly, but also how this line of thinking in a young person who's not being checked on can really take them to a bad place.
Right.
And that's what happened here with these two guys.
Yeah.
So yeah. I think there was, you know, there was a lot of meaning behind that for us as well to make sure that, I don't know, maybe if somebody reads this, that they'll make a different decision.
Right.
These thoughts in my head, maybe I need to go talk to somebody, a professional about it, because I don't want to go there.
Or a parent. If a parent, and they're like, oh yeah, my kid is locked away in the basement and I don't know what's going on down there. Maybe they'll take the door off the hinges because you're the parent.
Go down in the basement and check on your child.
Exactly. Like,
listen, I can see how that can happen. You've had your 54-year-old husband just basically drop dead on you out of the blue.
Yeah,
everybody's in shock.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, this is a man who is beloved in town, has this whole family that he loves and adores. Clearly, Mike loved his dad, I think, as much as he was capable of loving, or he looked up to him, or for whatever reason. And he goes into this spiral, but everybody else is grieving.
Right. Yes.
Because it's not that long. It's what, 2 years later, probably less than 2 years after his dad's death that they put this whole thing in action. How long have they been planning it? So I see a cause effect here, not justifying anything. Absolutely not.
Where the lights got dim.
Yeah. And because you're trying to cope with your loss of your husband, keeping your family going, keeping your house.
So all of a sudden, not just your life partner, but the person that provides for you every day is like literally just swiped right out of your life. And now you're a single mom. You've got a kid still in high school and he's real pissed off. I mean, and you've got older kids that are grieving the loss of this patriarch and you're having to pick up the pieces. I don't blame her.
Oh, no.
At all. I don't know where this certainly, it just would happen so easily because she had so much on her plate and she was devastated. And so I don't think there was any intention there.
No. But I think if someone else who's living a parallel life that's going in that direction and a child in that home or a nephew or whoever starts spiraling, maybe that radar just can tweak a little bit and it may really help.
Yes. Right. And there's something to say about grief counseling. I think grief counseling is really important, and especially for young children that lose a parent. I think grief counseling is almost a must because you have to learn, you know, with boys 17 years old, they are nothing but a swirling cyclone of hormones. Where do you put those feelings in that cyclone of testosterone? Like, it doesn't fit.
Right.
So, of course, it's going to come out as anger.
And they just, you know, at that age, they don't have the coping mechanisms that they need to have to make logical decisions.
Yeah.
They need guidance.
Yeah.
And it, unfortunately, the radar was not bleeping.
It just fell
off the radar when that was going on.
Yeah.
And this friendship that formed between these two murderers, this ride or die, it's the two of us against the world. It just was able to bloom and take life. I mean, it just was it was like we called it the dark passenger.
Yeah.
Because when they were together, it was like there was another entity in the back seat of their car riding along with them and feeding them these feelings of the world is against us and we need to get back control.
If you're having these horrible dark feelings and thoughts and whatnot, and there's somebody else who is also experiencing them, that is a validation too.
Right.
I'm not alone. Look, he gets it. He understands it. And off they go, spiraling into this dark passenger and accepting these thoughts as, we can do this. We can really do this.
Yeah.
And gosh darn it, they went and did it.
They did. They really did it.
And they didn't get caught and they covered it up. And that to me is somehow a nod to their intelligence in a really sick way.
Right.
Because they had to plan. They had to plan things. They had to carry it out. They were organized about this. Very organized.
And I'm not saying that Franklin had a bad police department at the time, but I don't think anybody thought anything like this could happen. No. So I don't know that they were, I think some of them maybe decided from the very beginning that this wasn't a murder, that this was something different, that he just ran away because they couldn't in their mind think, why would this student be killed?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I don't think it ever entered their mind that it was murder. There was no body, first of all. There was no crime scene, no body.
Right.
Why would you think murder?
It's not like there was blood spatter in the back seat or something. It was just an empty car with a window down.
Yeah. Right.
Exactly.
I'm not sure that they dug as deep as they could have dug. They were certainly a lot missed when they got the car.
Yeah.
They didn't process it for weeks, left it outside with the windows down. And I think they probably could have pulled some stuff out of that car if they had dusted inside or
looked for fingerprints or hair. But, you know, I think police investigation has come a long way in a very short time.
Yes.
And I also think this is a small town, a very small town with a small police force. Yes. And so, you know, you probably have one or two detectives in the whole police force because you don't need it. You know, yeah. you don't need it. So they're busy trying to track down stolen bicycles. They're not dealing with murder every day. It's not like Chicago or wherever, like a big city.
Right.
So
I don't know that it would have gone unsolved for so long. Mm-hmm. If it was in a bigger city.
Right.
Today in true crime, the first thing you think of is the husband did it. Look to the immediate family, right?
Right.
But then you move on to who was last with the victim.
Right.
And they put themselves there.
They did.
But they also lied about their interaction with him because they said
they were
supposed to meet him and he never showed up. And they took them at their word.
And part of the reason, because Mike was from a prominent family in the community, because the same thing happened to those other boys who were suspects, where he was supposed to go to a party with them. The police really, when I say they went after those boys, they made their lives miserable.
For 2.5 years, they followed them.
But they didn't do that to Mike and Fred.
No, they didn't. They didn't. And I think it was because Mike was from a prominent family. Everybody knew his family. And so they would have never suspected that. But those other three boys that were the original suspects, they remained the prime suspects for 2.5 years. And these kids it started out in high school.
Yep.
And they lived in that town. And the police continued to go after them, question them, almost harass them, to the point that they developed PTSD from that.
Yeah. To this day.
To this day. Because they were suspects in their best friend's murder. It was really difficult to handle.
Did they ever get an apology for being treated that way?
No.
I don't think so.
Not that we're aware of.
Mm.
The response they got was, "Let's doing our job." Yeah.
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 Listen, the whole plotting, the murder, it's upset that daylight's out of me. But you know what really got me was when I'm reading along and you're telling me that Fred makes this statement that he's going to kill Trent Whitley in front of witnesses, possibly a teacher. And after this poor kid goes missing,
within two weeks, no one
said a word.
The code of silence. Oh, my gosh. How crazy is that?
It's very, very disturbing.
Yeah.
Holy mackerel.
Because if one person had just mentioned that to the authorities, this could have taken on a whole different flavor.
It could have given
an anonymous tip line out there for all those years. People could have just called it in anonymously.
Oh, and listen, practical. There was a $5,000 reward.
Yeah.
1990, 1991, 1992. What could I have done with $5,000? I hate to be just garish about it, but.
Right.
Yeah. Good Lord.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree. It's unfortunate. And I look at those three suspects as victims as well. They were victimized by Mike and Fred very hardly because they watched these boys. They knew them. They knew what they were going through. They knew that they were suspects.
Yeah.
You know, so they victimized countless people in that town. Countless people. So it's very, it just really makes me mad.
It does, yeah.
It just really makes me mad. And part of it's because I'm protective of that town because that's our hometown too. But part of it, it's just like, how callous can you be? But I guess you are the most callous if you can shoot a person in the head, dump their body in a field, go back 2 days later, dig them up, move them again, and then just live your life. And that is just so callous to me. And so I guess they probably just looked at those other guys as that's just collateral damage.
Yeah.
And proof that we've gotten away with it.
Yeah.
It's very unfortunate.
And interestingly enough, the people that we have spoken to since the book came out that live in that town, the majority of them say we had no idea.
Yeah.
They didn't know. They felt like Mike had been pulled into it, that he just was the follower, not a leader necessarily in the crime.
Or was in the wrong place at the wrong time and then was scared to talk. Right. A lot of people went with that narrative, thought that's what had happened. So a lot of people reached out to us and said, wow, we had no idea. This is a game changer.
It does seem like it's been very easy for the community to forgive him.
Yeah. I mean, he lives back in that community.
Now I know that he's gone on to find the Lord, and he's very active in his church, and his church is very supportive. I think most of them have logged on and given us bad reviews online. So
I always know.
God bless them.
Yeah, God bless those churchgoers because they are really good with giving us bad reviews on Amazon, and yet they're not verified purchasers.
They're not verified purchasers.
So they haven't read the book.
Of course not.
But that's okay. We feel really good about what we did.
We did. We do. We feel like we did what we set out to do. And our ultimate goal was to memorialize Trent, which we've done. There is a memorial garden in the center of that town with a beautiful bench with his name on it on a plaque. And we did that ourselves. We did that out of the proceeds from the book. We blood, sweat, and tears. We dug the garden. We planted the garden. We did it all
ourselves. And Karen was just getting over COVID. And she had been so sick. Bless her. She was like...
I know. I was laid out on the sidewalk for most of the afternoon. I would dig a hole and then Ann would do all the planting. Or is that how we did it?
We started that way.
We started that way. And it's at one point, I was just laid out on the sidewalk. I was so exhausted, I couldn't even move. And she's still going.
But it's a beautiful garden. It's a butterfly garden. It's got lavender and rosemary and all kinds of beautiful
bushes that have flowers in the summer and spring, and then that have berries during the winter to feed the birds. And it's a very peaceful place. I know we've both had people reach out to us and say it's a very, very peaceful place to go and sit. And, you know, I've had people that have said, hey, I drove by the garden today and there was a man sitting on the bench. And you know, and I've had people say, listen, I went and had coffee at Trent's Memorial Garden today.
I actually got the opportunity in October to go sit for almost 2 hours and just read a book and just be. I was sending Karen pictures of the garden and we were talking about it. So it is a beautiful, peaceful spot, and it happens to be in the park right across the street from his childhood home.
Yep, where his car was found.
Yeah.
That is so beautiful that you did that. I'm quite frankly, I'm sorry that it took that long to have it done.
Agreed.
But clearly this story was waiting for you.
It was waiting to be told, and I think it was waiting for us. I think the universe said, it's time for it to be told, and somehow we were trusted to do it, and I think we're really proud of the way that we did it and that we carried out the goal, which was to memorialize Trent. He is a permanent fixture in that town now, no matter what.
Yep. Bolted to the ground to a big cement slab. It is not going anywhere.
No one can take it. We made sure it was not going to walk away.
Did you get feedback from Trent's family?
You know, murder is a very hard thing to talk about with the family. Oof. We had spoken to his brother at length when we were doing all of our research, when we first thought we were going to be doing a show for the Discovery Channel. And the investigator went and talked to Trent's dad. And it's still too painful. It's just too painful for them to talk about. His mother has passed away. One of his brothers has passed away. He has another brother that lives out of state. And we made a promise to the brother that we spoke to, that even if the show didn't get made, somehow we were going to find a way for the people in that town to say his brother's name. Because he said, nobody talks about my brother anymore. And we're going to find a way. We don't know how we're going to do it. At that time, we were like, we have no idea how we're going to go about doing this. But somehow we're going to do it. And we're going to find a way to memorialize your brother.
And he was so grateful. And I will tell you that about maybe 2 months. 3 months after we got it all installed, that brother passed away.
He did.
And so, just so thankful. He was never well enough to go out to see the garden, but he knew that the book had been written and the garden was there. And he passed away, and I hope that he was proud. I really do.
There's little doubt in my mind he was. And listen, I understand. I just needed to know if they were involved in what level, but we're telling this story. You knew these people growing up. You know, I'm reading this story and I was emotional about it and have no ties and connections to them. So deal with this loss the way you have to.
Yeah.
And I think knowing that what you did, that his name is spoken, Trent Whitley.
Yes.
That I'm sharing that name. I'm sharing your story as much as I can. It's terribly, terribly important to say the name.
Yeah,
say your name.
To make this about him, not about yes. the person or people that did it.
Right.
Not about them. It's not
their story. It's his story.
Right. And that's what we, I think, did. We met with the murderer, but we took that story and made it Trent's story.
Right.
And that was really important to us. And it's going to be important to us. You know, this is a series now. We've decided this is our path. And we started our next book, like I said, by like this much, but it's all under the Say My Name series because we want these victims to be remembered for who they were put on earth to be, not for who they ended up being, because nobody is born to be a murder victim. Nobody.
And you know, it's not always easy. It's not easy because most of the information that you find out about people that are murdered is in their obituary.
Yeah.
So there's not a lot of information that you can pull in. There's only so much you can put in. You've got to tell the story of what happened. There's only so mm-hmm. much you can do. It's not some kind of a biography on his life. This is the most important event that happened in his life, unfortunately, yeah. was his demise. The goal wasn't necessarily to talk about his life because we didn't really know a whole lot about it. We did as much as we could.
Yeah.
The goal was to have people in the community recognize that this terrible thing happened to a member of their community. And we always yes. wondered about it. And now we know what happened to him. And now there's a memorial in our town for him because he needed a memorial in that town. He grew up in that town. His family has lived in that town for forever.
Yeah.
So it's yes. not, you know, doing your research and stuff on murder victims is not easy.
No.
So we have
believe me.
Story in some kind of a way.
Yeah. They get forgotten. Their legacy becomes what happened to them.
Right.
And we have to change that narrative, especially in the true crime community. We have to change the narrative because it has to be victim central or you're in it for the wrong reason.
Right. I agree. And, you know, we full-time jobs. So it's not like we're authors and we're making authors. Millions of dollars. We don't have a big publisher. We did our own self-publishing.
Yep.
But our ultimate goal was to tell the story and to memorialize Trent.
Yeah.
Well, I think you achieved that.
You look glimpse inside the mind of a murderer.
Woof. Yeah, that's.
Oh, yeah. You hit that out of the ballpark. Let me tell you, that was incredible.
Well, he made me.
I read so many murder books, some that I do and some that I choose not to do. And you're so right. Many times looking for the victim in the story can be really difficult.
Yeah.
That's why I always do what I call second cast. Third episode is part of second cast, where I'll finish the story, but then I will have looked up and researched the victims in as much detail as I can find, going back to old newspapers. I'm sure you did the same thing, pulling out statements from people who knew so-and-so and where they were and yeah. what they did. And it's really grueling. The biggest challenge I had is when I did She Married the Green River Serial Killer.
Oh.
Gary Ridgway has 49 victims.
Right.
And if I did a minute on each victim, there's a whole episode right there.
Sure.
I managed to say something about each and every one. And it was a labor of love. Yeah. It's not all about him. The book came from the viewpoint of what happened when she was married to him.
Yeah.
There are victims here that I'd like to talk about and highlight. And I did the same thing we did. I did a book on Ted Bundy.
Right. Oh, wow. I think what happens is it's easy to write about the murderer because once they do these heinous crimes, every part of their life is dissected and studied and analyzed. And it's printed in media, talked about on talk shows, in podcasts, things like that. It's the easy part. Is the murderer.
Right.
And I think you're right. It is a labor of love to go and find something about that victim that shows that victim was a viable human person and was not born to be a victim. They had a different purpose on this earth and to give some flavor of who they were before this horrible thing happened. And it is a labor of love because it's not easy to find it all the time.
No.
No, you really have to dig. It's hard. And thank you so much for remembering Trent, for bringing this case to my attention, because I sure had never heard of it. I'm happy, thrilled to be promoting your book and the story so that more people can say his name.
And there's our guy.
There he is.
Yeah. What a sweetheart. Yep. Well, we appreciate that you've read the book and that you're doing this to highlight it. It's another way for Trent to get his name out there.
Oh, yeah.
And his story to be understood by other people that are outside of our little hometown. I think we felt like not many people were going to read it, but I think more people read it than we thought were going to read it.
So we are it's been a year since we published, and we've sold over 900 copies of our book.
Yeah.
Not bad.
That is fantastic.
That means 900 people out there have said Trent's name.
That's right.
And that's so important.
That aren't necessarily from Franklin or even Virginia.
Correct.
Yeah that's even better. So that's why we appreciate you, Jill, and talking to us about this, because again, some more people are going to hear about him.
Yep.
Yeah. I tried to put him and what you found about him at the center while I'm telling your story, because it's your story. So I want to make sure I do that accurately and respectfully. And by the way, I don't tell you everything, so you still have to read the book yourselves. Yeah. Murder Bookies.
Exactly. There's so much.
You need to read it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you get a little insight into what that quirky little town is about.
That's right.
And the way that we left our mark on that town in more ways than one.
Definitely. Ladies, thank you so much.
Oh,
Trout, you've been so good. You've been such a good puppy.
He's going to have to go on a diet.
I know. I think he's gained like 3 pounds just sitting here tonight because he's had so many treats to try to keep him quiet.
Well, he was a wonderful co-host. And ladies, thank you so much.
Jill, thank you.
Thank you, Jill.
Again, another opportunity to hang out with you.
Exactly.
Yes. We have to come up with more. Honestly, we've got to put our heads together.
I'm sure we will. We'll get creative.
Definitely. I'll let you know when the episode airs.
And listen, stay sweet.
Don't murder.
Because if you kill people,
we'll talk about you and we might write a book about you.
We will write a
and
book.
We're about never going to be nice about it.
No.
Well, there you go. I can feel the murder rate drop. There it is.
You are right there. Save the world.
There's the deterrent. Here they thought it would be the death penalty.
No. Because Karen and Anne are going to talk about you.
All righty. Bye-bye, ladies. Take care.
Bye.
Well, Murder Bookies, that wraps up my interview with Anne and Karen, the authors of Click, Click, Click. I truly had such a wonderful time chatting with them and getting all their insights into how the book came about. I'm so glad to hear about Trent's Memorial Garden and that there is a place to remember him in Franklin, long overdue, and the brainchild of Anne and Karen. Thank you for listening, Murder Bookies. I see you as you hear me. In 2 weeks, we will start my next book, Frozen in Fear, A True Story of Surviving the Shadows of Death by Jane Carson Sandler. I met Jane at CrimeCon 3 or 4 times at this point, a lovely, gracious woman and a survivor who would eventually testify against her rapist turned killer, Joseph DeAngelo, the Golden State Killer. I started this podcast with Michelle McNamara's All Be Gone in the Dark, episodes 1 and 2, on his reign of terror. So now it's time to do a story on a survivor and the aftermath. So that's coming in 2 weeks. Now please take a few minutes to leave an awesome review and share your thoughts with me at jill@murdershelfbookclub.com. You can find me on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. You can join Patreon for $4 a month and help me pick our next book that I'll be featuring. Links are on my blog at murdershelfbookclub.com with sources, photographs, show notes, our snack recipe, and wine pairing too. Always trust your gut and lock your doors and windows. Written and produced by Jill, all rights reserved.